Welcome to Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm here with the show's producer, Gary Jr. II. So today's show is another of my explorations of very nerdy subjects, things I sit around and think about all the time. This one has to do with what the Supreme Court said about Donald Trump's place on the 2024 presidential ballot. Now, just to recap, in December, Trump was disqualified from the Colorado primary by the state Supreme Court, which decided that the 14th Amendment, which prevents people who have taken the oath of office from and then participated in an insurrection from running again for office, they decided that he was ineligible for that reason. And the Supreme Court ultimately took up the case. Recently, they decided that Colorado could not interpret that amendment on its own, that we need Congress to decide how states do that, something that's not in the Constitution itself. Seems to me that's a real overreach by the justices, and I want to have a conversation about why we should tolerate that and whether we should be scared of a court that's willing to do it.
Yeah. All nine judges ruled in favor of former President Trump. They say he should stay on the Colorado ballot. But there were four justices that characterized the opinion that Congress should enforce the provisions in the 14th Amendment as too far. And that brings up some questions about what too far means for me initially. I'm already wondering, like, how do you determine whether or not something is too far and whether or not something is just right? The court was pretty clear in saying they're not going to make a judgment on whether or not Trump participated in an insurrection. I feel like this is kind of the opposite or the flip side of what we were talking about with Primus last time, right? It's the first time it was what happens if they remove him, what that danger is. And now that they've decided it, no, you can't remove him because of those consequences. Now we're talking about this current element, which is now if they've gone too far in giving that jurisdiction over to Congress.
Yeah.
And so that's going to be interesting, a really granular conversation about how this legal element is interpreted by the courts. But I'm sure it's going to be one that's going to be pretty enlightening.
And we've got a great guest for this conversation. Richard Primus is a law professor at the University of Michigan, a senior editorial advisor for the Journal of American Constitutional History. He teaches law theory and the history of the U.S. Constitution. So right voice, right mind on a pretty critical question.
Right conversation.
Yeah. So I think we have to start with a little bit of a recap because we spoke to you right before the justices heard arguments in this case about Donald Trump being kicked off the ballot in a few states. And we talked about the 14th Amendment and how this clause of it was supposed to work. And what I remember you saying at the time was that you expected that the justices would not allow states to do this. That's exactly what they did, and they did it unanimously. But I also remember you saying that there was a question about how they would do it, how they would reach their conclusion, and whether they would go further than the issues in this particular case. And, of course, the opinion it did go further than that. At least a majority of the justices wanted to go further. So let's start with maybe a brief description of how they got to where they got in this case, beyond the particulars of Donald Trump's eligibility for the ballot.
Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, which provides that a person who has previously taken an oath to uphold the Constitution and then participates in an insurrection cannot hold office again in the future, needs an enforcement mechanism set up by congressional legislation. That states by themselves can't enforce Section 3, that there has to be a mechanism that Congress creates to explain how Section 3 is going to be enforced. And as a matter of constitutional design, that is to say, if you were building the system from scratch, there is a logic to thinking that something like this makes sense. And the logic goes like this. it makes sense to have a rule that insurrectionists can't then serve in your government. But it's problematic if you have a system where decisions are being made separately in 50 different states about who's an insurrectionist when people are running for a national office, because there's a concern that people will act for partisan reasons, right? And like deep red states will come up with flimsy arguments to disqualify one set of people, and deep blue states will come up with flimsy arguments to disqualify a different set of people. And so what you should have is a uniform national process for deciding who is an insurrectionist and therefore cannot serve. And so it might make some sense to have a system that says there needs to be one uniform national process. And one way of doing that is to say Congress needs to set up the system. Congress could say, here, we're creating a court process for a case to be brought in federal court to have someone declared an insurrectionist. And if that happens, that person is disqualified. Or Congress could create some sort of special administrative board or agency that would be in charge of deciding. But one way or another, that Congress has to legislate in order for this to happen. That's the crux of what the court said in this case.
Yeah, and that was part of your prediction, right? Was that they wouldn't allow states just to each decide on their own how this should be enforced.
Yes, that's right. Now, there's a little bit of an irony here, because what the Colorado Supreme Court actually wanted was not a system where every state would decide on its own.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Colorado said, this question has come to us, and so we have to decide it, and so we're going to decide it, but we're staying the result of our decision pending review in the Supreme Court, because the Supreme Court is ultimately going to have to decide this. In other words, the Supreme Court is a national decision maker.
Right.
If the Supreme Court were to rule that someone is or isn't an insurrectionist, that would settle the question in a uniform way for the country. That would get us the uniform adjudication, right, that we need. The Supreme Court declined to do that in this case, right? The Supreme Court's opinion doesn't say Donald Trump is an insurrectionist, and it doesn't say Donald Trump wasn't an insurrectionist. It lets stand Colorado's judgment on the facts, right, that he participated in an insurrection, and just said, but the state can't have the authority to make that a reason to keep him off the ballot.
Right, right. So one of the things that I think really jumps out, at least at me here, is that this is an extra requirement that the court is imposing beyond what the Constitution itself says. And Section 3 of the 14th Amendment is not clear about how you determine whether someone is an insurrectionist, I suppose, or how states should enforce it. But it does, for instance, say that Congress can vote by 2/3 of each house to exonerate someone from enforcement of this particular provision. And so it's not as though they didn't imagine that Congress had a role here. It's just that they didn't assign this particular role to Congress. And so the Supreme Court is going beyond, I guess, in some ways, its own mandate, which is to interpret the Constitution. It's not really to add extra provisions to it. Am I right about that?
Yeah. The 14th Amendment clearly contemplates two things that Congress can do with respect to Section 3 disqualifications.
Mm-hmm.
One is, as you said, it can vote by a 2/3 supermajority to remove the disqualification from someone who is an insurrectionist. Right? They can grant amnesty by a 2/3 vote. The other thing they can do is they can legislate to create mechanisms of enforcement, including the uniform national process that the Supreme Court said it wanted. The 14th Amendment, Section 5 of the 14th Amendment, which is the last section, says Congress has the power to enforce the provisions of the 14th Amendment. So it's quite clear that Congress, if it wanted to, could pass laws that would tell us exactly how the process for adjudicating who's an insurrectionist has to work. The problem with the court's ruling is that the fact that Congress could pass those laws doesn't mean that the 14th Amendment requires Congress to pass those laws to have any force. That's not the way the whole rest of the 14th Amendment works, right? Here's the way the 14th Amendment works in general. The 14th Amendment says a bunch of really important things. Section 1 of the 14th Amendment says that no state shall deny any person the equal protection of the laws, right? Mm-hmm. Section 1 of the 14th Amendment says every person born in the United States is a citizen. Section 1 of the 14th Amendment says that no one can be denied life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Those rules all apply whether Congress does anything to legislate their enforcement or not. Mm-hmm. They're just the rule. You can walk into a federal court or even a state court anywhere in the country and get enforcement of those rules, because that's what the Constitution requires.
It's what it says, yeah.
Correct. Now, because Congress has the authority to enforce the 14th Amendment, Congress can make laws explaining how 14th Amendment cases should be handled. Right? So Congress, using its enforcement power, could make a law that says anyone who sues a government official for violating the 14th Amendment and wins shall be paid $100,000 in damages. Right? It's a way of regulating the enforcement. But the things that are forbidden under the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause and Due Process Clause are forbidden whether Congress legislates or not. And state courts in every state in the country have the obligation to enforce the 14th Amendment in cases that come before them. So one would think that the same would be true of Section 3. One would think that if a case comes before a state court saying, this person engaged in an insurrection, the state court is supposed to say, well, did they or didn't they?
Right. Right.
And if they did, they have to enforce Section 3. Now, Congress might step in. Congress might say, hey, it's really important that Section 3 adjudications be uniform and national and not state by state. And therefore, mm-hmm. we are going to make an enforcement regime that says the enforcement of Section 3 will occur only in federal courts, or will occur only by a suit brought under the following conditions in the United States District Court for the District of Columbia in front of a three-judge panel, right? They could make a rule about how it happens. But in the absence of that rule, Section 3 doesn't disappear. It's still there. Right. And you would think that states would need to enforce it. It's sort of as if the court was saying, look, it would have been much better for Congress to make a statute giving us a uniform rule here. And they didn't. And we really wish they had. So we're going to say that until they do, nothing happens. That's the extra. And that, I think, is not really a plausible part of the court's theory.
Yeah. And I want to talk more, of course, about the way in which the court did this and how it kind of compares to some other behavior, I guess, we see from the justices from time to time. But before we do that, I really want to talk about the importance of where they're doing this, right? Back to which amendment they're interpreting in this way. This is the 14th Amendment, which is, of course, part of the three-amendment package 13, 14, and 15 that come after the Civil War and fundamentally change the nature of the Constitution and really a lot, many people believe fundamentally change the nature of this country. They outlaw slavery. They outlaw discrimination, and they extend the franchise to African Americans who had been previously left out of it. Interpreting the 14th Amendment in this way, which restrains its enforcement, I guess scares me a bit, right? It scares me because of the other important things here, and I wonder what you make of that kind of precedent. We haven't seen the court, that I can remember, monkeying around with the enforcement of these provisions in this way. And of course, this is, you know, Section 3 is not the same as Section 1. It's not seeking to do the same thing. But it is, again, part of this second founding, many people believe, of the United States after the war. How dangerous is it for the justices to do that?
So I think it's a great question. I think you're right about the importance of the Reconstruction Amendments. The 13th and 14th and 15th Amendments are critical in the Constitution. The 14th Amendment is probably the single most important amendment of all the constitutional amendments. Without the 14th Amendment, the modern constitutional regime in the United States would be unrecognizable to us.
Mm-hmm.
Like so many of the things that we think of as bedrock constitutional principles in modern America come to us from the 14th Amendment. And that's not just the principles of equality. It's actually all the principles of individual rights that we associate with things like free speech and the freedom of religion and everything else in the Bill of Rights. Because prior to the 14th Amendment, those rights only ran against the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
If the state of Michigan wanted to censor this radio program because it didn't like the ideas, before the 14th Amendment, there would have been no constitutional obstacle to that censorship. It's the 14th Amendment that gives us all of those rights against all the state governments, which is just huge. Now, it happens, and I think that you made reference to the idea of the Reconstruction Amendments as a second founding of the Republic. Mm-hmm. I think that's a good image. I think it's very much worth thinking about it in that way. That set of amendments, that set of changes, makes the government that we have afterwards like just and legitimate in a way that we could not have had otherwise. Now, where I think I want to suggest something a little bit different is in the question of what the court's attitude toward those amendments has been up until now.
Sure.
In the second half of the 20th century, the federal courts had a relatively expansive attitude toward the Reconstruction Amendments and the mm-hmm. project of the Reconstruction Amendments. From the time of Brown versus Board of Education in 1954 forward, the court said these things mean a lot, and the constitutional law of them needs to mean a lot. In the 21st century, there have been some important retrenchments.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the court has tightened up, as a general matter, Congress's discretion to enforce the 14th Amendment under Section 5. The ruling that we're talking about sounds like it is very solicitous of Congress's power to enforce the 14th Amendment. But in a bunch of previous cases that have been decided over the last few decades, Congress has tried to do things to enforce the 14th Amendment, and the court has said, actually, that's too much.
Yeah,
that's an over-enforcement relative to what Congress is allowed to do. Congress is stepping too much on the toes of the states. The first big case like this involved a law called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which was passed in RFRA, which was passed in Congress in the 1990s as a way of expanding the reach of the free exercise of religion, mm-hmm. and expanding the degree to which the free exercise of religion was protected against state governments. And the Supreme Court said, actually, Congress can't expand the free exercise of religion in this way against state governments. It's an overuse of its power to enforce Section 5 of the 14th Amendment. They've gotten stingier about that. You would never know that looking at the decision in this case, right? The decision in this case speaks very positively about Congress's role in enforcing the 14th Amendment.
Okay, we need to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to continue this really wonderful conversation about our Constitution and its interpretation with Richard Primus of the University of Michigan Law School. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. We're back with more Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm glad that you've joined us. We're talking with University of Michigan Professor of Law Richard Primus about the recent decision by the Supreme Court that will, at least for now, allow Donald Trump to continue to be on the ballot in Colorado, a state which had decided that his participation in the January 6, 2021 insurrection was a reason to disqualify him from the ballot. There is a section of the 14th Amendment of our Constitution that says anyone who's taken the oath of office and then later participated in an insurrection is ineligible for future office. The Supreme Court says that Congress needs to be more specific about how that provision works before it would allow a state like Colorado to enforce it. Richard, before the break, we were talking about the kind of signal that the justices were sending with this opinion and what it means to the 14th Amendment, which of course is a very critical part of our very idea of individual and civil rights in our country. I want to talk about, though, also the way in which this reflects, in some ways, the manner in which the justices sometimes essentially try to render provisions of the Constitution ineffective because they don't particularly like them or they don't particularly like the outcomes that they produce. And the things that, I guess, jumped into my mind when I saw this ruling were those kinds of interpretations. And I think in recent years, in the 21st century, the early part of the 21st century, they've been doing that with regard to a lot of individual protections. I'm thinking interpretation of the Eighth Amendment, for instance, which forbids cruel and unusual punishment, which seems to be not particularly well enforced. I'm thinking of some provisions of the Fifth and Sixth Amendments, which are intended to protect criminal defendants and their rights when they are part of the process. So I want to give you a chance to either highlight the line I'm drawing between this particular ruling and some of those others, or draw an X through it and tell me, no, it's actually not that bad. The sky's not falling.
So I think there are two things going on. One is the kind of thing that happened in this particular case, where the court issued a ruling that basically, for practical purposes, nullifies the effect of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, at least where candidates for federal office are concerned. Under this decision, states can still disqualify people from state office, but not from federal office. And I think that that pretty much nullifies Section 3, because when the court says no one can be disqualified from federal office unless Congress legislates, the court is pretty confident that Congress isn't going to legislate.
They're never going to do that, right? I mean, it would be a remarkable, almost miracle, I think, if you saw Congress take this on and actually pass it.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, no one expects that to happen. It would require a degree of unanimity on fundamental issues in Congress that is very, very rarely seen, right? There was that kind of unanimity is the wrong word, but there was that kind of unity of view about a bunch of these things in Congress during early Reconstruction, which is what got the amendments passed in the first place. But that's under the conditions of just having fought a civil war and mostly only having the winners in the room. We don't have anything like that now, and no one expects it, right? So in this case, I think they've effectively nullified a piece of the Constitution. I don't actually think that they nullified this piece of the Constitution because, as a matter of principle, they don't like the idea, right? I don't think that the members of the court are in principle opposed to the idea that insurrectionists shouldn't serve in the government. I think what they had a unanimous agreement on was the idea that they did not want to make a decision that would be an enormous interference in the process of a contested presidential election, right? That they would prefer that the electoral process play out, right? They have a way of thinking about the role of the courts that says we should not be having major impact on this, and so we want to duck. And because the question was presented in that particular context, they needed to reach this result. If the question had been presented regarding like some race for Congress that you know, didn't really have the full attention of the country, that didn't matter very much and so forth, it's nobody's telling really whether they might have done something different. But with the stakes this high, they wanted to duck, and so they ducked. That's, I think, you know, pretty much all that happened here. More broadly, it is true at any given time that the court seems to give a very capacious a set of rulings under some constitutional provisions and very narrow, sometimes almost trivializing rulings under other provisions of the Constitution. Mm-hmm. And the question is, which are which, right? So you talked about, for example, the Fifth and Sixth and Eighth Amendments, which are amendments that protect the rights of people who are accused of crimes, yes, and also the rights of people who are convicted of crimes against things like cruel and unusual punishment. The Supreme Court in the second half of the 20th century took a more robust view of several of those protections, yes, than the court previously in history had, partly, I think, because they were reacting to practices in other countries, like totalitarian countries like Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union, where there was nothing like protection for the accused or for the prosecuted. And the court started to think, we need to get much more serious about how we handle this here. A lot of it was bound up with the need to redress the Jim Crow system of justice, mm-hmm, in which like African Americans had very little in the way in practice of rights. And so the Supreme Court got quite serious about those things, and those provisions got more robust in the second half of the 20th century. In this century, a lot of those provisions are being cut substantially back again. Yeah. Here are two examples. First, one of the most famous constitutional rulings we have that creates rights in this space is, of course, the Miranda decision, right? Anyone who watches cop shows at any time in the last 60 years, much less anyone who's had direct experience of the criminal justice system, knows that the police are supposed to read a set of warnings to you telling you about what rights you have, about remaining silent, about having an attorney, and so on and so forth. In the last couple of decades, the Supreme Court has cut back very dramatically on all of this.
They sure just to have. Say, yeah,
the police still have to read the warnings, but the rights themselves have gotten very thin. If you don't use the magic words to say, I invoke my right to silence, the courts will say, you haven't really invoked your right to silence.
Right.
There are lots and lots of ways that the prosecutors and the police now have ways around these rights that they didn't have earlier. There's a much bigger one that some people are worried about that is coming, which is there are justices of the Supreme Court who now have the view that there is no such thing as a right to have an attorney provided for you.
Yeah.
When you are accused of a crime. The Sixth Amendment says that a person who's accused of a crime has the right to counsel for his defense. And for the last 60 years, we have understood that to mean if the state wants to lock you up and you're too poor to afford a lawyer, the state has to give you a defense lawyer.
Sure.
There are now justices of the Supreme Court who say, actually, all that means is that if you have a lawyer, the state can't prevent you from using that lawyer. The state can't prohibit the use of a lawyer. But the state has no obligation to give you a lawyer. That would be a seismic change in our justice system. And it is something that at least a couple of the justices of the Supreme Court would now like to see happen. Yeah. On the other side, there are other provisions of the Constitution that the court now gives much more robust attention to than the predecessor court. The Second Amendment is a leading example, right? That used to be one that was small in its impact that has gotten much larger. So I don't think it's that there's a general tendency of the court to ignore things or exaggerate things in the Constitution. The question at any given point is, which are the things in the Constitution that the court is inclined to treat very robustly, and which are the ones where the court wants to turn the volume down?
Well, and one way to look at it, and I think there are a lot of people increasingly who do look at it this way, is through a political lens, right? The rights of criminal defendants, of prisoners, are seen as liberal causes. The rights of gun owners, for instance, are seen as conservative concerns. Is it that simple when we think about the court?
It might not be 100% that simple, but it's probably 75% that simple. It is a problem for the system now that the interpretive views of judges on major contested constitutional issues tend to align relatively well with the ideologies of the political parties that appoint them. It hasn't always been like that. The court that decided Roe versus Wade in 1973 was a court.
It was a conservative court. Yeah.
It had seven Republican appointees who split 4-3 on the question, and two Democratic appointees who split 1-1 on the question. In other words, it wasn't your political partisan affiliation that determined which way you went on the constitutional issue. Even in the 1930s, in the huge epic battle between President Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal and the Supreme Court, which for a few years kept blocking the Supreme Court, the justices on the Supreme Court who said, we don't know about this stuff, weren't all Republicans. They weren't all Roosevelt's political adversaries. It was a mix on both sides of Democratic and Republican appointees. The system works relatively well when there's a difference between the way people look at issues of constitutional interpretation and the way they look at issues in politics. And we right now are at a time where those things align pretty well. And that's a problem for the system because it allows people on each side to say about constitutional rulings they don't like, that's just politics.
Right. Okay, we're going to take another quick break, and when we come back, we'll continue this conversation with Richard Primus of the University of Michigan Law School. Stay with us. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. We're back with more Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and thanks for joining us. We're talking with Richard Primus, a law professor from the University of Michigan. We're talking about the Supreme Court and its decision recently that Donald Trump will stay on the ballot in Colorado, even though that state believes that his participation in the January 6, 2021 insurrection at the Capitol disqualifies him from running for president, according to the third section of the 14th Amendment to our Constitution. Richard, we've been talking about what this means and what this sort of maybe extrapolated to mean about other parts of the Constitution. But with the court going as far as it did and adding a requirement, really, to the literal language of the Constitution to make it harder to enforce, I think the big question is what we as citizens in this country can expect from this court when it comes to the protection of the rights and privileges that the Constitution extends to citizens, but also their attitude toward the literal meaning and literal interpretation of the words of the Constitution, which is something that the justices themselves argue about quite a bit. What faith should we have in a meaningful interpretation of what's in the Constitution from this court?
I think it's really hard to know. There are a number of justices on the court who sort of wrap themselves in the flag of the literal language of the Constitution, but who push come to shove are as willing to depart from that literal language as anyone else when it seems like really the right thing to do to them in a particular case. Sometimes they don't notice that they're departing from the literal language
or say they don't notice
when they do it, right? But they do. The argument that that the Constitution's language should be read literally and literally only is usually an argument made in two contexts. One is by a court that is really confident that the literal language makes sense, and so it can pound the table and say, this language, and that's all we're doing, and that's all. And the other is by people who are in opposition to the court, who want to say, what you're doing is no good. Here, look at the language, right? And that's all there is. A number of the present justices are people who spent, who were socialized into the legal profession in opposition to the court, right? Justices like Neil Gorsuch and Clarence Thomas, who very much did not like a lot of the doctrines of the Supreme Court as they existed when they were earlier in their careers. And for them, the idea of criticizing the court as departing from the literal language of the Constitution was in that role sometimes quite appealing. It is not the case, though, that it's very hard to read the Constitution literally to give anyone all the things that they really sincerely believe the Constitution ought to deliver.
That's a really great point.
Right? Here's an example. I'm very sure that I have a constitutional right against the President of the United States prohibiting me from exercising my religion. And I'm confident that I could walk into any court in America and get an injunction defending that right. But I can't find it in the text of the Constitution. Right? The First Amendment says, Congress shall make no law abridging the exercise of religion. And there are a lot of terms in the Constitution that might mean more than one thing, but I have a hard time saying that Congress means president and then telling you that what I'm doing is just enforcing the words in the Constitution. Mm-hmm. Right? We have a set of settled norms and understandings about constitutional rights that sometimes don't exactly map the words of the Constitution. And at that point, there are two options. You can say, okay, I guess I don't have that right, right? And we're doing just the literal text of the Constitution. Or we can say, pretty much everyone actually thinks that there are some principles that aren't only the literal text of the Constitution. And now we have to have a fight about which ones. The danger of the second thing, of course, is the decisions will often be made by people whose intuitions about what rights you should have are different from your intuitions. But you don't fully avoid that danger by saying just the literal text of the Constitution, because even when it's just the literal text of the Constitution, people will sometimes have quite different ideas about what that literal text means, right? So, for example, what is the right to have counsel provided for your defense?
Right.
Is it the right that someone has to give you a lawyer, or does it just mean we can't take away the lawyer you have? Going for literal doesn't answer the question. You still have to ask the substantive question, which way does this right make sense?
And how do I make sure it's enforced or protected? I'm reminded of a book that former Justice Stephen Breyer wrote in 2005. It was titled Active Liberty Interpreting Our Democratic Constitution. And in it, he kind of outlines this doctrine where, you know, erring when something is unclear on the side of expanding liberty rather than restricting it was the way that he saw his job on the Supreme Court. And it seems to me that's pretty much in line with what, if I read what the founders were arguing about and talking about when they wrote the Constitution, it seems pretty close to what they were thinking.
So I like that idea a lot. The difficulty that I have is that there are a bunch of cases where expanding one person's liberty is contracting
infringes on someone
else's.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? So your right to free speech is in tension with my right to peace and quiet, right? Many people will argue that a pregnant woman's right to decide to terminate the pregnancy is in conflict, right, with the unborn fetus's right or liberty, right, to be carried to term and live. I'm not saying that there's no way to answer these questions, right? Like, we all have our views about which of these rights are real and which of these rights are more important than others. The point is just that it's not always easy to say, err on the side of more liberty, because it is usually possible to identify a liberty claim on either side of a contested question. And then the question is, which one needs to win?
Yeah. I mean, we have that argument about lots of things, as you point out. And I guess it does come down to, who's doing the interpreting, right? Who's deciding which liberty interest wins out?
A lot of it does. That is to say, you can have systems that do better and worse jobs of constraining the discretion of officials. Like, as systems around the world and through human history go, our system at this date is still pretty good at the rule of law, right? At making what happens depend on the rules and the system rather than
arbitrary
who is
discretion
in office. But that's only But that's only relative to like the disaster that happens in human society in so many other times and places, right? It doesn't work perfectly, and it very frequently doesn't work very well. And even in our system, there is no substitute for having responsible, thoughtful people, right, making the decisions. It matters, it matters, it matters who is in office to make those decisions. There's no way around that.
Okay. Richard Primus, law professor at the University of Michigan, it is always great to talk with you, but it is especially great to have your expertise brought to bear on these really complicated questions that we have to deal with when they come from our Supreme Court and challenge us to think about our Constitution. Thank you so much for joining us on Created Equal.
Happy to be here.
So, Stephen, that was a very nerdy, wonky conversation about the intricacies of the legal process, of this court process. And I feel like I can't help but wonder how different judges make their interpretations of the Constitution. Some people are trying to be in line with what the founders believe, and others find ways to probably think of what the law means today. I can't say I feel fully settled, given we've had this long in depth.
I think it's never going to be settled. Most judges do a little bit of both, I think is the truth. They are restrained when they want to be, and then they're more aggressive when they want to be. I think that last point that Richard made, though, is the key. You need to have people in the position of appointing judges and justices who are thinking about it in that way and really thinking about it in order to make sure that you're appointing people who will protect the right rights at the right time.
Part of what Richard Primus explained, that at some points in time in the history, the court decides to stay out of or reduce their judgment or interpretation of the Constitution in this law and allows the Constitution to explain everything that's there. And at other times, they've been going further in establishing more provisions as to how the Constitution ought to be enforced, like this particular situation. That, to me, at least explains a little bit of why I see a shifting in how the court makes its interpretations. That, for me, at least helps settle my concerns a little bit about what where that interpretation comes from. Because all this time, I've been thinking the court has one interpretation uniformly, and they come from different places, but when it comes to the Constitution, they're all supposed to interpret it in a way that, you know, the formers intended it to be.
That's it for this episode of Created Equal. You can listen to recent episodes at WDET.org and make sure to subscribe to our podcast. Created Equal is produced by Kerry Jr. II and David Lines. Our audio editing is by Connor Anderson, and the music is by Sam Bovian. Our digital production team is Jenny Sherman, Dave Kim, and Sophia Joswiak. Our program director is Adam Fox. Created Equal is a production of WDET, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University.